C'est possible que la situation actuelle vous fasse ressentir des émotions difficiles ou même de la détresse. Si vous éprouvez de la difficulté à réaliser les actions du quotidien, des solutions existent. Rendez-vous sur québec.ca/allez-mieux ou appelez Info Sociale 811. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Need your help. You're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Sociale 811. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Airing first on Asheville FM, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist, anti-authoritarian radio show broadcasting from occupied Soligi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from people, projects, and struggles around the world engaging in the long project toward liberation. You can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net or at protonmail.com, or send us letters at P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina 28816. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm is a locally owned co-op specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.
This week, we are pleased to present a guest interview with author Christian Williams about his new book, Resist Everything Except Temptation: The Anarchist Philosophy of Oscar Wilde, which was released in June 2020 from AK Press. I found this interview extremely illuminating. Perhaps, like many other people who might not have strong ties to either academia or popular education models of learning, I had sort of written Oscar Wilde off as this kind of white, wealthy, dead, rich guy who carried little to no relevance apart from a model of queerness that we could look back on. This interview very much proved that this isn't the case, and that he and the circumstances around him very much influence how we as queers and as anarchists can sense historical threads that pull on our lives very tangibly today. Thanks a million to Scott for researching and conducting this interview. You can learn more about the author, Christian Williams, who is most known for his book, Our Enemies in Blue, which is a critical history of American policing and police, at his website, christianwilliams.com, and that's Christian with a K. One announcement before we begin from our comrades at the Charlotte Uprising. Charlotte jail support has been getting extremely targeted harassment for some months from CMPD and the Sheriff's Department. In times of rebellion or revolt, it is the support infrastructure that are often the most vulnerable to repression and violence. All of their supplies have either been seized or destroyed by the police. If you would like to support them re-upping their much-needed materials, you can Venmo them at Ash Williams, CLT, or Cash App, House of Kanatika, and we will post those in our show notes. Before the interview, here are some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Come like a boss! One of my earliest memories, I couldn't have been older than 3 years old. It was in the kitchen of my parents' home in Des Moines, Iowa, and my dad was holding me while my mom was on the phone, and I was trying to reach out to grab the ceramic Pillsbury Doughboy cookie jar. I lost my dad on March 24th due to complications after heart surgery. He had been waiting to get scheduled for the surgery since before Thanksgiving, but he wasn't a priority. He didn't matter to the people who make life and death decisions. He should have. He was a really extraordinary guy. I know I'm biased because he was my dad, but even so, he was an exceptional human being. He was kind and generous and gentle. And he really loved life. He and my mom were together for something like 55 years. This has really devastated her. My dad wanted to be cremated, so my mom has his ashes in an ornate walnut box that he would have liked, as he loved to do woodwork. He made canes after he retired. I'm an only child, so my mom's alone now, and it's hard on her because she's really alone. She's in her 70s and can't risk getting COVID-19. She's constantly injuring herself doing yard work and other nonsense she has no business doing. She needs me home. I've been meaning to share this for some time to help maybe work through this loss, but it's been hard to reduce to words. There's the pain of missing him, but there's more. I think of all that he went through and sacrifices that he made for my mom and for me. He worked at Ford for 30 years. He hated it. Factory work. Another of my earliest memories, my mom and I were in the car dropping my dad off at the Ford plant. He had on a denim jacket and carried one of those old black metal lunch boxes, the kind that was rounded at the top to hold the thermos. He was in his 20s then, shaggy hair and beard. Beyond this loss and grief, I feel a sense of injustice for him. The day he died, the world kept spinning. There was no pause, no moment of reflection. Traffic kept moving on the highways. Everyone kept shopping. The stock market closed slightly up for the day. Apart from my mom and me and a handful of close friends and family, it was as if he had never existed, as if he never happened. Somewhere at the Ford plant on Romeo Plank Road in Michigan, an assembly line worker stood right where my dad spent decades, and that worker performed the same job my dad used to do. He or she has probably never even heard of Paul Swain. So, beyond the grief, it was hard for me to wrestle with this sense that the world moves on like that. In fact, it doesn't even blink. Not just for my dad, but for all of us. It makes it feel sometimes like all the struggle and the sorrow, the misery and even the joy, that none of it counts. It's there and gone like ashes in a strong breeze, and then so are we. I share this now because it feels like the world over we're in an era of loss, with COVID-19 raging and the fascists on the march, with knees on our necks, and gums pressed in our backs, it feels like everything is for nothing sometimes. It feels like doom and gloom. So maybe that is the point. Maybe these cumulative losses, this intolerable meaninglessness, this sense of the hopeless, it all confronts us, and it confronts all of us, and it awaits our collective response. For me, personally, I never met George Floyd. I didn't know him. But I knew Paul Swain. I remember when he was young in that denim jacket, facing the daily small injustices, the humiliations and the reductions. So the thousands of spectacular and terrible atrocities we witness are also accompanied by hundreds of millions of more mundane ones that we all experience. I guess what I'm trying to say is that as I navigate the loss of my dad, it's important for me to think about how this collective struggle against the current dystopia is to stop the brutality like we saw on the street in Minneapolis for 9 minutes. But it's also to stop the slow-roasted brutality to which we are all victims. I don't just want to end police or prisons. I want to end factories and sweatshops and wage slavery and nation-states and chemical warfare and all the components of this immiserating shit society in which we live and shop and work and die. I want to struggle and win because all of our lives and all of our deaths should matter. Until we have that kind of a world, we owe it to those we love and to those we've lost to fight for them and for ourselves. This is Paul Swain's son. This is Paul Swain's son. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his latest address at Sean Swain, number 2015638, Buckingham Correctional, P.O. Box 430, Dillwyn, Virginia, 23936. You can find his past writings, recordings of his audio segments, and updates on his case at seanswain.org, or now follow him on Twitter at Swain Rocks.
I'm talking to Christian Williams, who just published the book Resist Everything Except Temptation, The Anarchist Philosophy of Oscar Wilde. Christian, would you please just introduce yourself, your pronouns, your name, and any information that you think would be pertinent to the listeners of The Final Straw?
Sure. I'm Christian Williams. I'm the author of a handful of books, probably most famously Our Enemies in Blue, which is a history of the police in the United States. As you mentioned, my most recent book is Resist Everything Except Temptation, The Anarchist Philosophy of Oscar Wilde, which is probably the book I've written that has taken me the longest to write. I think I started working on it about 13 years ago.
Oh, wow. Is it nice to have it out? Was it like a big passion project for you?
Yeah, it was the thing that I was always working on and never finishing and had a surprisingly hard time interesting publishers in. I think everyone I approached about it, their first response was, that sounds great, but no. And then eventually AK asked to take another look at it, and I don't know, here it is.
Well, yeah, it's exciting, and I'm glad that, like, it, you know, the shadow of Oscar Wilde kind of loomed large for a long time on anything that was related to him, so I'm glad that that's not still persisting, and they published the book. I also, just incidentally, as an aside, like, I was writing my dissertation with a chapter on Wilde and got super sick during it, writing about Dorian Gray, and, like, ended up in the hospital, and I, like, couldn't finish that chapter, so I don't know if there's, like, a curse with writing on Oscar. Yeah. I've always thought about that. All right. Well, so I'm really excited to talk to you about Oscar Wilde and anarchism. The main argument of your book is that to really understand Oscar Wilde, or at least to understand Oscar Wilde as a political thinker, we need to think through about all of his art and philosophy through the lens of anarchism. And it's really exciting to read the book and see how Wilde kind of like intersected with anarchism and anarchists at the time. To read about the history of like the fear of anarchism that we're presented with today still, and then just like getting another perspective on Wilde as a person and his relation to the aesthetic movement and the beginning of the queer movements. And all of these things I think still are pertinent today. But so I think a lot of people probably have heard of Oscar Wilde, maybe even read a little bit or heard his epigrams, but do you think you could just give a quick overview of like who he was as a figure and a person?
Sure. Let me see if I can do this at all efficiently. So Wilde was born into the Irish aristocracy, educated at Trinity College in Dublin and then at Oxford, where he excelled in classics, immediately became sort of an early example of a person who was famous for being famous, having developed a kind of celebrity and notoriety before he had really accomplished very much, and then leveraged that notoriety into a year-long, a little bit more, lecture tour in the United States on the aesthetic movement. After that, he went on to publish a novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, and then really rose to prominence with a set of four society plays, which were, you know, sort of nominally comedies about the manners and dramas of the elite of English society. At the peak of his popularity, he became embroiled in a dispute with the Marquess of Queensberry because Wilde was having an affair with Lord Alfred Douglas, who was Queensberry's son, which led Queensberry toward more and more public and offensive behavior toward Wilde, which then led Wilde to file a ill-advised lawsuit for libel, which Queensberry very aptly turned back on him and produced criminal charges for gross indecency, which was the criminal term for homosexuality. That led Wilde to prison for a couple of years. He lost his family. He lost his fortune. Lived the short remainder of his life in exile in France and died virtually penniless.
Well, thanks for that overview. And I want to touch on a few of those elements that you brought up, but I just, because this is an anarchist radio show podcast, I would start with anarchism in particular. Did Wilde identify as an anarchist?
There are two occasions when he did. One was an interview in which he said, once I was a poet and a tyrant, but now I am an artist and an anarchist. And another, in a separate interview, he said, asked about his politics, he said, I'm a socialist, but we're all socialists nowadays, so I must be something more. I think perhaps I'm an anarchist. There were other occasions where he sort of flirted with the term, and probably my favorite is in a letter, he tells the story of being on a sailing trip with these two young men and them getting caught in a storm and it taking hours for them to get back to port. And when they got there, they were freezing cold and completely drenched. And they rushed back to their hotel and ordered brandy. And the hotel proprietor sadly explained to them that because it was after 10 o'clock on a Sunday, the law prohibited him selling brandy. But given the circumstances, he decided he would just give them the brandy. And Wilde's comment was along the lines of, not a bad outcome, but what utterly stupid laws. And then he finishes by saying that the two young men are, of course, now anarchists.
If I knew that that was the way to convert people, I'd be taking more of sailing trips with the young men. I'm always wondering. So he used the term sometimes, but clearly anarchism and anarchists were out and about in Wilde's time. I'm wondering a little bit like what the common conception at the moment was of anarchism and anarchists and how it might have changed since then.
At the time, it was considered practically synonymous with terrorism, and in particular of a like foreign Eastern European sort of conspiratorial, random blowing things up kind of terrorism. That reputation has in different forms haunted anarchism really since the beginning. And while the sort of bomb throwing aspect has always been very much a minority affair of what anarchism is about, it wasn't entirely baseless. I mean, there was a tendency called propaganda by the deed, which had this theory that a spectacular attack against the symbols of authority would reveal authority to be both artificial and vulnerable and inspire the masses to an uprising. In fact, it never worked out that way. And it was a theory that was partly developed under the circumstances of autocratic rule in Russia and then exported into Western democracies. In Russia, where it was basically illegal to even speak about anarchism, right, there was a certain rationality to moving to direct attack. And that was also, in a way, legible to the population who was, you know, also suffering under this kind of censorship. But when it moved into the Western countries, really the effect was to baffle the population and to largely turn them against anarchism as a, you know, it just became synonymous with things randomly blowing up. Wilde, in fact, in one of those interviews that I quoted earlier, immediately followed his statement that he must be an anarchist with, but of course the dynamite policy is quite absurd, meaning that even at the point where he was embracing this term partly for its shock value, he also felt like he needed to distance himself from its more extreme and somewhat bloody elements.
And that's interesting. Do you think that there's a way that he uses the term specifically for its just like surface level or superficial subversiveness, or as you said, the shock value?
I think that, you know, he always wanted to be just shocking enough to be interesting and not so shocking as to actually get himself into trouble, which was a line that he was not always successful in judging, obviously. And so, you know, yeah, I would suspect that some of his rhetoric about that was chosen for, like in those particular instances in particular, was chosen for the way it positioned himself outside of the mainstream. I mean, in particular, when he said, well, I'm a socialist, but we're all rather socialist nowadays, so I must be something more, right? It suggests that he's looking for the position which is just slightly too far. Interestingly, though, when he, in his most directly political writing, which is called The Sole Commander of Socialism, even though what he describes is a socialism without the structures of coercion or authority, and he's very explicit about that, he doesn't use the term anarchism anywhere in the essay. And in fact, he begins one paragraph by saying, communism, socialism, or whatever we choose to call it, sort of signaling that the particular distinctions may not be that important, and in any case, the word is certainly not the thing that matters.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's something that I've been thinking about a lot, because there's a strategic way to use the word anarchism to get people interested, to get people to talk about things, and to use the way that it's presented or represented in media. But then attachment to the word doesn't necessarily help if people are sort of doing their own thing. That was really illuminating to me to hear you put it that way. Since you brought up the soul of man under socialism, kind of the central argument of your book is that this provides a key to give Wilde's whole body of work a certain kind of cohesion through the lens of anarchism. I was wondering if you talk a little bit more, you mentioned a little bit, but a little bit more about some of the ideas that he presents in that essay. And then if you want to move on a little bit to how it shows up in other writings of Wilde's.
He begins the essay by saying that the main value of socialism is that it would free us from the burden of living for other people. That basically in a society where everyone's needs were being taken care of, it would be possible for people to pursue their own interests and to develop what is unique about themselves in a way that the burden of earning a living and the responsibility for taking care of, you know, your family, your dependents and all that sort of thing really limits a person's ability to freely explore whatever it is that they find fascinating, both in the world and in themselves. And so he starts right at the beginning by arguing that the purpose of socialism is that it would make a kind of individualism possible. And the, in his conception, these two notions of socialism and individualism are tightly bound together. And that it's possible for certain extremely privileged people to exercise a kind of individualism under capitalism. But for the vast majority of humanity, their lives are too taken up with drudgery and the struggle for survival. And that a socialist economy would relieve them of that set of burdens and therefore makes individualism a universal pursuit. And he argues that when that becomes available, then we'll see this whole renaissance of culture and art and science and intellectual and aesthetic sort of blossoming of the human spirit. And then at the same time, he argues that any kind of authority or coercion is corrosive of that entire project, and that therefore no authoritarian socialism would be acceptable. What's needed is socialism as this kind of voluntary association between free and equal individuals,
right,
which I'm not the first person to note is basically the anarchist conception.
Right. That's interesting, the like emphasis on individualism. So in the way that like that puts him in a different place than some of the other like aesthetic aesthetes and decadence, like it made me think of that famous line by the Goncourt brothers about, you know, living our servants do that for us. The way that Wilde talks about some people, you know, the people who are allowed to live some version of individualism or to create beautiful things or even to think like the profound thoughts are relying on the work of others to do that. So his individualism isn't like a kind of selfish or narcissistic individualism, but one that is trying to extend that privilege to everyone.
Exactly. And what I argue in the book is that if we take Wilde's political writing, and in particular the Soul of Man or Socialism, seriously, it helps us understand a lot of his other work, and that you see this marriage of individualism and socialism and that version of individualism that should not just be the special property of the aristocracy show up in other respects. And maybe the place where that pairing is clearest is in those lectures on aestheticism that he delivered in the United States, where in addition to talking about the importance of sort of surrounding ourselves with beautiful things and treating life as itself as a kind of art, meaning making the process of living as beautiful as possible, he also talks surprisingly much about labor and about investing in the skill and the craftsmen of the workers such that the process of work becomes a creative pursuit and is pleasurable and then also produces beautiful things, rather than everything being simply judged by its commercial value and the worker simply being this kind of cog in a giant capitalist machine where all of his initiative and all of the creativity is removed from the process in order to maximize the efficiency of profit.
Yeah, that was really exciting to me to read your argument in the book. One line that especially stood out to me, you make the claim that wild socialism is more aesthetic than economic because it takes, this is me quoting you, takes as its model the artist rather than the proletarian and is as much concerned to free the repressed bourgeois as the oppressed worker. And that sticks out to me because I think it could help us just thinking about anarchism today. But I was wondering if you maybe would elaborate a little bit on this idea of like shifting the revolutionary subject away from the traditional understanding of a worker. It's the kind of a disciplined, manly person. And maybe that could also verge onto a critique of work too. Because a lot of anarchism, you know, goes away from this kind of idolizing of the worker as the person that will lead us to freedom. So yeah, if you could talk a little bit about like what this shift in wild thinking allows us to see for like revolutionary politics.
Yeah, I don't know if he had an idea of a revolutionary subject, as you put it. Like I don't know that he thought that there was a particular class of people who were going to be responsible for the transformation of society, or at least not a particular economic class. But what I meant in that passage was that rather than seeing the proletariat as the class that would become all of humanity, right, and therefore the model of how human beings would be, he looked to the artist. And so part of that is, I think, shows the influence of William Morris, who considered himself a Marxist, but whose politics are pretty hard to fit into any current conception of Marxism. And Morris largely thought that the purpose of socialism was to, rather than sort of a standard Marxist conception where industrialization will produce a particular class of worker who will then take over society, Morris thought that the purpose of socialism was to destroy industrialization, that he wanted to get rid of the factory system and its rigid division of labor, and in particular, this conception that there was a class of people who sort of designed and created and imagined the products of the world and therefore the world. And then there was this other class of people who were basically just like hired hands who just like did the work by rote without any input into the process. Instead, he wanted production to take the form of skilled artisans bringing their full creativity to their work and also therefore experiencing the work as an expression of their creative selves and finding joy and pleasure in the process of creation. And Wilde basically took Morris's conception on the whole, which suggests that under socialism, rather than society being organized on the factory model with this mass of proletarians who basically just like have their position in the assembly line and do the same rote task over and over again, that society would be organized as this free collective of artists and craftsmen who would be able to express their individualism in the creative process while also providing for the needs of the society. So I don't know that it's a question of the revolutionary subject. It's more a question of like, under socialism, is the world populated by proletarians or is the world populated by artists? And the hope was that under conditions of freedom and equality, work would be more like art, and therefore the individuals doing it would be more like artists and less like assembly line workers.
Right. And that's interesting. That talks to the ideas of, yeah, like you said, industrialization, modernization. I mean, in Wilde's concept of socialism, he does have a kind of like, there are machines that do the kind of dirty work so that people don't have to, and they kind of replace that class of people. But this isn't to enable some hyper-modernization, but to enable a kind of smaller scale of life that allows people to engage in the pursuits they want rather than this like larger idea of like a, I don't know, driving civilization on or something like that.
Yes, I think that's exactly right.
There's another thing that brought up for me, though. It's interesting because, you know, we think of aestheticism, we think of Wilde and art, and just like art with a capital A, there's already a kind of class distinction that's assumed within there, right? Like high art versus other forms of art. But Wilde, you know, maybe through Morris and also Ruskin, I know who's like a teacher of his, isn't making this big distinction between high art and crafts or other forms of creation. So then he's also kind of envisioning a classless art world. Would you say that's right?
I would say at his best, that is right. I think he was also prone to a certain amount of snobbery and ready to claim certain privileges of an artist with a capital A that may not extend to everyone in society. And both sides of that showed up in his trials, where on the one hand, when they tried to cite his writing as evidence against him and, you know, brought in the picture of Dorian Gray and set of aphorisms he had contributed to an Oxford magazine and that sort of thing. And they would ask him things like, well, what is the interpretation that an ordinary person would put to these lines? And Wilde would say something to the effect of, I know nothing of the opinions of ordinary people. I'm only concerned with the opinions of artists, right? And so he was willing to fall back onto a sort of special status for the artist, and in particular that artists could only be judged by other artists. At the same time, though, the prosecutor was absolutely outraged that the young men that he was associating with were often men of the lower classes. They were servants of various kinds or people who were just frankly out of work. And though nominally the court was concerned with the sort of homosexual nature of these relationships, the fact that he was bringing these servants into polite society was as much a focus of the cross-examination as any sort of sexual relation. And so the prosecutor would repeatedly ask questions like, is this the sort of young man that a gentleman should associate with? And Wilde would respond, absolutely, if that young man is interesting. And he said over and over again, I recognize social distinctions not at all, meaning he didn't care about their origins. He didn't care about what they did for a living. What he cared about was their personal beauty and their radiant personalities. And that in particular was outrageous to polite society in a way that mere same-sex relations, there was a lot of that sort of thing at like the British public schools and then at Oxford and Cambridge. The men of Wilde's class were, you know, somewhat ambivalent about that.
Right.
But the cross-class nature really was outrageous to public opinion and ultimately to the law.
Yeah, and that's something that you elaborate a little bit in the book in a way that I found very interesting, that people at the time who were, some were anarchists and some weren't, who were kind of thinking about the cross-class same-sex relationships as a sort of liberatory engagement. And that made me think that there's like sort of seeds of the radical gay liberation or queer liberation movements already in place in the end of the 19th century when these things were kind of being defined. I mean, I don't know if any of these thinkers would go so far, but I was like reading into this idea that like men across class having relationships would be a sort of undermining of capitalist society. Could you talk a little bit about how the ways of this kind of cross-class relationship were being thought by the queer and anarchist thinkers at the time?
Yeah, this wasn't just an anxiety on the behalf of the aristocracy. The men engaging in these relationships often did sort of theorize that it was going to destroy the class barrier and thus crash the social hierarchy. And that for them, that seemed like an advantage, right?
Yeah.
Of course, in retrospect, that all seems very naive, right? Like the idea that wealthy aristocrats paying young men of the lower order for sex would destroy class relations just seems sort of fanciful. But it was a popular notion among radicals in those circles at the time. And I think to understand that, we need to remember sort of the difference between the traditional British class system and the sort of emerging capitalist system, where, you know, they still had the trappings of an aristocratic hierarchy, so that class position wasn't simply a matter of who had money and who didn't. And the divisions between the classes weren't simply a question of one class being an employing class and one class being a laboring class. The differences were also cultural, and it was possible to be kind of a destitute aristocrat, and it was also possible to make a fortune and yet remain ultimately sort of a middle class person, right? And that was a matter both of the culture and the expectations and the values that people in those positions would have, but it was also a matter of how they would be regarded socially. So that in some way it would even be more respectable to be a impoverished aristocrat than it would be to be a like wealthy merchant, right? And so there was this element where simply having kind of intimate contact with people of other social classes seemed subversive, seemed destructive of the barriers that kept them apart. And in particular, Wilde's interest in the culture of the lower classes, and then also his interest in exposing them to what we would call high art, seemed deliberately like trying to erase that cultural line between the upper and the lower. Though, interestingly, he had basically no interest in the middle classes at all.
Yeah, which I guess makes sense. So there's something interesting there, too, because, so, you know, Wilde initiated the libel suit against the Marquess of Queensbury because he left this card at the hotel where Wilde was staying. That one, at least one reading you say in the book of that card said posing as a sodomite, right? It's like a misspelling. So he was being accused of posing as a homosexual. So like this, that just made me think about how the class positions weren't necessarily tied to actual wealth, but you could kind of portray the image of an aristocrat. And I wonder to what extent that relates to an understanding of aestheticism, like the kind of the idle dandy and the aristocratic bent of that, which you're arguing that even though that's like one understanding of aestheticism, it actually has a kind of anarchist political or an ethical value or valence or something. So yeah, I mean, I'm kind of thinking about, wondering about this idea of like posing as queer, posing as an anarchist, and how Wilde uses these different positions.
Yeah. So artificiality was in Wilde's schema a value rather than like a vice, right? And part of that was that he had this idea that the purpose of life was this kind of self-cultivation, this sort of self-creation, which means that to a certain extent, it is going to be an artificiality, that is going to be an element of artistry to the life that you create for yourself and the character that you develop in yourself, and also the presentation that you make to the world. Mm-hmm. And Wilde very deliberately created an image of himself early on as this sort of idle genius and also as this person who in some ways was outside of the categories of conventional society. And he relayed that with his sort of flamboyant dress. He created that image by making a habit of saying just outrageous things. As he matured, the outrageous things that he said came to have more and more of a subversive undercurrent to them. But especially early on, it seems like he was often just reaching for the thing that was going to outrage public opinion. So there was always this matter of posing. And one of his aphorisms is that it's only shallow people who don't judge by appearances. And one of the things he meant by that is that it is the appearance that we choose for ourselves, right? That is the way that we decide to present ourselves to the world. And that that's important, right?
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's like you can tell a lot about somebody from what they choose to show you. So there was always this self-consciousness to Wilde's presentation, especially publicly. And there was connected in that a gendered element where he presented himself as the sort of, you know, foppish, flamboyant aesthete, which was always interpreted, like the dandy was always understood as sort of an effeminate character. But it actually wasn't really until Wilde's scandal that it was fully identified also as a homosexual character. And so he was often seen and sometimes mocked as this living affront to the ideals of masculinity. And this is hard for us to kind of imagine now, but at the time that wasn't necessarily associated with homosexuality, which makes Queensbury's claim that he was posing as a sodomite a little bit complicated. And part of the work that the trial did was to construct this notion of what a sodomite is like, such that a person could be posing as it. And this gains a kind of circular momentum where the image that it constructs is partly the negation of the ideal of a respectable middle-class family man, but partly just the reflection of the image the Wild has been projecting all along. And so in the course of the trial, what a sodomite is, like the figure of the sodomite, is built so that Wild will resemble it. And then once that equation takes hold, Wild really becomes the icon of sort of what a gay man is expected to be like. I'm borrowing here from the work of Alan Seinfeld, who wrote a book called The Wild Century, which makes this argument at about 250 pages. So if you're interested in how exactly that happened, like that is the place to look.
It seems really important, and like something maybe a lot of people don't know is that like that we've inherited a kind of gay male type or stereotype that can be traced back to Wilde and these trials, that in even over, you know, over 100 years, a lot of that hasn't changed. That kind of identity type that Wilde embodied, or even like the lampoon of Wilde's identity, still marks understandings of gay male effeminacy and campness, like Sontag talks about him. So I think you bring that out really interestingly, but like in your book, the thing that I think is really important that you add is that, you know, in the aftermath of Wilde's trial, the like queerness of Wilde sort of has an influence on anarchist thinkers at the time. So in a way that like, you know, not only is like Wilde's queer identity becoming politicized and codified, but also there's like an anarchist element to that. And I wonder if you could like, you know, elaborate a little bit on that, how the trial on his sexuality became influential for anarchist thinkers.
Sure. This went in a lot of different directions and had several different elements. But maybe the clearest is that Emma Goldman, for example, and other American anarchists as well, but Emma Goldman in particular, was initially extremely sympathetic with Wilde, but simply as an example of the puritanical hypocrisy of the legal system and as a victim of state oppression. It wasn't until later that she became exposed to the sort of sexological literature that was elaborating this theory of homosexuality, where she realized that it wasn't just a particular case of the state doing what the state does, but there was also an element that Wilde's trial was intimidating and terrorizing for an entire group of people. And that it wasn't just a matter of individual suffering and individual persecution, but that there was a group element to this. And so it became important to her to specifically stand up for the rights of homosexuals sort of as a class, rather than simply opposing the state putting people in prison, because of course we're against the state people putting people in prison. Another direction that developed was that, and I guess I should say also that in Great Britain and in the US, the anarchist sexual politics at that time were already interested in sexual liberation, but mostly in the framework of a critique of marriage and free love and advocacy around issues of legitimacy, meaning really the rights of children who are born out of wedlock. And so adding the sort of queer element to that, they were already kind of primed for that development. And then what that meant was that it wasn't just that Wilde's trial affected anarchist sexual politics, it meant that a particular kind of sexual politics came out of that, that were interested in gay rights as an expression of sort of sexual freedom overall, right? So there was a natural affinity between the way anarchists were already thinking and the sort of challenge and rethinking posed by the Wilde trial. Another direction that developed was that in Europe, and especially in Germany, individualist anarchists took a somewhat different lesson from the Wilde trial and were less interested in conceptions of group identity and more interested in understanding it simply as in terms of sort of individuality, individual rights, an individual person's ability to express themselves and find pleasure in whatever way they chose, regardless of laws or social convention or religious or moral precepts. And that, curiously, also circulated back into the United States, partly through Benjamin Tucker and his paper Liberty, which reprinted some of the European coverage of the Weill trial and also editorialized on its own and very much in a more sort of individualist libertarian kind of approach. So there were a couple of different developments from that in terms of how Wilde's persecution shaped anarchist politics in the generations after.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like, I mean, it's still obviously, I mean, this is still a kind of problem and paradox within queer liberation, the idea of like an identity and a group type or a minority group demanding rights, and then a kind of queerness that critiques and wants to do away with identity. And obviously, like the way that you were outlining Wilde's understanding of posing and like artificiality is already showing kind of ambivalence to that, even as he's being put in the position of defining this type. So it's interesting to see that these things that are still sort of, and you know, anarchists today are always critiquing identity politics as well, whether or not they're queer. So I think it's interesting to see that these things were already happening at that moment.
Wilde himself directly addressed this question in a short story called The Portrait of Mr. W.H., which the story itself is complicated, and I'm going to do my best to sum it up quickly, but basically it involves a relationship between two men, one of whom has a theory that Shakespeare sonnets were inspired by and devoted to a young boy actor named Willie Hughes, the Mr. W.H. of the title, and then persuades the other man of this. The other man then goes and engages in a relationship with a third man who also tries to persuade him of this theory. And the whole thing is in some way an excuse to make this argument about the history of homosexuality and its influence on culture. And so it looks at the presence of homosexuality in ancient Greece. I mean, there's no way to talk about this that isn't anachronistic. I should say that first of all. Like, Wilde never used the term homosexuality, but the presence of homosexuality in ancient Greece, the importance of homosexuality in the Renaissance, the importance of homosexuality for Shakespeare, and then, you know, more recent examples. But the thing about the story is that they have this argument about the sonnets, but there's no proof for it. And in order to try to persuade each other, they engage in this, like, each of the men engages in this fabrication of evidence in different kinds. And the evidence itself, including the picture of the title, the portrait of the title, is a beautiful work of art, but it's also false. It's also a fraud. And each of the men in these lines, once he persuades the other one of the importance of this theory, is then fatally compromised and dies. Like, one of them by suicide, one of them by consumption. And at the end, you're left with this, on the one hand, this exercise in the construction of a homosexual genealogy, like a cultural genealogy of homosexuality. And on the other hand, the story itself exposes that construction as this kind of artifice and draws into question the wisdom of sort of latching your identity onto anything exterior to yourself. And so it's both this exercise in the creation of a gay identity, and then it's also this deconstruction and critique of that exercise at the same time.
Yeah. And that seems like it could also be like a fitting parable for the attempts to like naturalize or biologize sexuality and gender too, even towards like sort of increasing rights for so-called like gender sexual minorities. Like these stories that we're telling ourselves, I don't know, he in that essay or whatever you want to call it, it's like a story essay.
Yeah, it's a little hard to know how to characterize it. It queers our categories.
Right. I mean, it's all just part of the seduction anyway. Yeah, I think that your reading of that's really interesting. One of the things then, like, so still kind of going on this idea of identity, the thing that stood out to me after reading your book was that, you know, the legacy of Wilde in a way entangles these three groups of people that are kind of like unwanted or undesirable: anarchists, the aesthetes or the dandies or decadents or whatever, and whatever was being defined at the time as homosexual or around that time as homosexual, we might say queer now. And thank you for pointing out that we're like talking, you know, pretty anachronistically, but yeah, just these three types, right? Anarchists, aesthetes, and queer people, even at the time were sort of confused in people's minds and had this sort of like specter haunting people as like, you know, unwanted types. Could you talk about how that sort of legacy still persists today, or are these entanglements of these different positions politically, artistically, and sexually persist today?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of it I think you've already hit on. I mean, anarchism as it existed circa 1895 was already a sort of hospitable environment for a gay politics to emerge in a way that most other sort of political realms were not, right? Because anarchism already had this critique of sexual morality. It already had this critique of the family structure. It was already advocating for, you know, birth control and the rights for children who were born out of wedlock and the equality between men and women and free love and all of that kind of stuff. So it was ready for the addition of the concern of homosexuals. And I think once that took root there, of course, gay politics have then expanded far outside of anarchism and even arguably outside of the left. But it's now just very infused with the sort of culture of anarchism and also the values and the sort of self-perception of what anarchists expect ourselves to be like.
Right.
The fusion between sort of aestheticism and queer politics has developed somewhat differently, but is also like remains there, right? Where, you know, on the one hand, this becomes sort of an annoying stereotype. And on the other hand, it's also something that gay men especially sort of celebrate about their shared culture, such as it is, right? Where it's like there's an expectation that they're going to be these sorts of fabulous creatures with good style sense and immaculately decorated houses and an interest in music and theater and that sort of thing. And also for the same reason, it's also always a little bit suspicious when an adolescent boy takes too strong an interest in painting or poetry, right? Like, so there's a weird kind of both good and bad aspect to the two of those things coming together and forming like a type or a stereotype. The connection between aestheticism and anarchist politics, I think, is in a way more complicated. On the one hand, it means that on a shallow level, it has helped inform the attraction of anarchists to sort of the artistic avant-garde, which has shown up, you know, really throughout the 20th century, from like Dada to the Beats to punk. I'm really in real Marxist territory there. And on a deeper level, though, I think that the notion that life should be this sort of splendid adventure and that the way individuals live should be reflective of their character and personality rather than bounded by convention and predictable and productive, but not necessarily very creative or interesting. I think that has done a lot to maintain sort of the spirit and attraction of anarchism. And that puts us more in like, you know, the lineage of the situationist to crime think, right? But then there's also this paradox, I think, where especially in the last couple decades, anarchism has taken a very moralistic and sort of puritanical turn that has also always been sort of a feature of it. You know, at sometimes, if you look at a figure like the early Alexander Berkman, his ambition toward martyrdom and his sense of asceticism and his harsh judgment of other people is just annoying. So there's always been that kind of puritanical element to anarchism as well. But I think it's at our best that is counterbalanced by this free and flowing and sort of urge toward the beautiful. At the moment, it feels like the sort of purist and puritanical element is more to the surface, and the notion that life should be anything other than to be something more than just the political struggle and the urge to purify oneself and the group of people around you, it seems to have receded. So I worry that we're at the moment insufficiently aesthetic. And I wish we could bring that back more to the surface.
Yeah, I mean, it's the beautiful idea. I really like the way that you politicize Weil's aestheticism, because, I mean, it is such an old argument in a way that's kind of like tedious and boring, that like even like the Sartrean committed literature is against the art for art's sake, because that is like amoral or even elite. But your reading of Weil shows that like even within the stuff that isn't explicitly political, there's like an ethical and political understanding that we can get. Like you say, one line that I really liked in your reading of the plays is that Wilde's evasions often hide the seeds of subversion. So there's a way of reading Wilde that, you know, when he's not saying like, I'm an anarchist and let's like, you know, smash the state, he's not saying that, but there's something that happens in his work that allows the subversiveness of his thinking to come differently, right? Like not hitting you over the head. Mm-hmm.
Let me run with a couple points of that. One is that I think that had his politics been more direct in his writing, probably his work would not have survived as well as it has. And while I think that there is even something which on the surface just seems like this exercise in silliness, like the importance of being earnest, if you read carefully, it's actually shot through with political concerns, concerns about legitimacy, concerns about the rights of women, concerns about Irish independence and the Fenian bombings, right? Like there's all sorts of political elements, political themes, political subtexts, political references in what at first seems like just this almost Dadaist banter about nothing in particular. But I think had Wilde instead taken the approach of like a movement writer or a message writer, then the work would seem dated and less interesting and wouldn't remain as fresh as it actually does. The other thing I wanted to say, and this goes back to aestheticism, is that my argument about Wilde's aestheticism is that it's not just the places, especially early in his career, where he said things about like the importance of labor and reconceiving of labor as a kind of art. It's also that he pushes this sort of values where beauty doesn't have to justify itself. And that's really what art for art's sake means. It's like it doesn't have to have a moral message. It doesn't have to have a social use. It doesn't have to be commercially viable. That just the fact that something is beautiful and gives you pleasure is itself important. And I argue that that is an implicit critique of the values, especially of Victorian capitalism and what Max Weber would later articulate as the Protestant ethic, which was supposed to value, you know, sobriety and hard work and thrift, and that every moment of every day was supposed to be invested with this improving moral weight, which both meant making yourself a better person, but it chiefly meant making yourself a better person through hard work, right? Yeah. And Wilde's aestheticism is just like a torpedo in the hull of that ship. Interestingly, for us, I think it is also a good corrective to the more stoical and dour and sad-faced parts of left-wing thinking. And, yeah, you know, the kind of Marxism that thinks that we should sacrifice everything for the party, or the kind of anarchism that thinks that, like, the main purpose of politics is to morally cleanse ourselves of anything that may be socially compromised, right? Like that kind of Puritanism, that kind of stoicism, that sort of often workerist, but also often workaholic element, I think needs something to temper it. And I think the Wilde work, if we take it seriously, and also if we are willing to sort of accept it as lightly as he.
November 12th to December 2nd, one of North America's major documentary film festivals will take place.
Montreal International Documentary Festival.
RIDM.
A 23rd edition, more engaged and accessible than ever.
In a virtual format never seen before.
The program includes the 100 best documentaries of the year.
This fall, we will be online, where all stories meet.
And you?
Check out our website at ridm.ca.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, feminist waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. Later in the month of November, we'll be chatting about environmental justice and its intersection with gender. And in preparation for that episode, we were looking back at a piece we did a few years ago that features Maya from Missing Justice. Maya speaks about environmental racism in Canada. Keep in mind, this was a few years ago, and there have been some developments and setbacks since, but much of what Maya shares is